Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
This episode of the Team Never Quit podcast is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. Navy Federal celebrates veterans of all branches and their families on Veterans Day and every day of the year. If you want to learn more about how they can help you, go visit NavyFederal.org. The Team Never Quit podcast is proudly sponsored by Tractor Supply. Tractor Supply offers some amazing special discounts on hero holidays for their hometown heroes. If you want to learn more about this, go check them out at tractorsupply.com/hometownheroes.
And then along with my grandfather, I told you, that was the Army vet in Japan. When I went to war, he told me two things. He called me and I said, I'm going to tell you two things about combat, Mike. Take care of your men and don't ever give up.
Never quit radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. As always, thank you guys so much for listening and watching, and please don't forget to hit that like and subscribe button wherever you're getting this show. So today, before we kick it off with our special guest, let's do what we always do, and let's answer that Patreon question of the week. This week we've got, what is something small that just makes your day a little bit better?
I got it.
Tell me.
My little grandson walks up and says, hey, Pop, you want to go play football?
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I'd say my dogs.
Except when they bark at night.
Yeah.
Last night they were...
There's something going on outside. They were all about it.
There must have been possums or raccoons or something on the porch, and they would not let up. And they're normally not barkers unless it's night and they can feel something coming up to the house, and they were going crazy. Yeah, the dogs are good in the morning. I think mine is when you walk out, take that first step outside, and it's like a perfect, crisp, cool air. And it's like, ooh, I love this weather. So it doesn't happen a lot in the Houston area, but right now we get that.
We have it now.
Yeah.
Got it today.
Yeah, today was great.
Feels really good.
Yeah, I love that. Like
those mornings where it's 55 something degrees and then it elevates into the 70s, low 70s, mid 70s, that's our great weather. Mm-hmm. I think we have that real hot weather in the summertime to keep everybody from living in Texas.
Yeah, you had that great weather going through Buds, didn't you?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like it really helped.
Yeah. That's another story altogether.
I know.
What about you?
Man, this time of year, probably knowing that I can wake up basically any day and there'll be some sports on.
Hunter is a sports
fanatic.
He will watch any sport at any time. He knows all the teams, all the players of every category of sport that there is.
Wow.
I literally started watching ESPN every morning again just to make sure I keep up with him. So we can have, you know, something.
I do too.
He'll start throwing some, it's great, right? It's the best news.
I love it.
It's the best. It's been around forever. I mean, ESPN is freaking awesome, man.
It is.
NBA just started.
Yeah.
Rockets out there.
Freaking Curry, man. Yeah. He was on point that day.
Did you see my favorite Rockets game last night?
Yes. Double overtime.
That was crazy.
1 point. That's a good question. All right, brother. Thank you for doing this, man. We're going to get into it. I'm excited about you coming on here. It's been a while since we've seen each other, but I've been looking forward to this moment for a while.
Me too.
The way we do it, I like to introduce you to the team, man. We're going to get into a little bit about your backstory. So if you could, man, tell me where you're from. Where were you born and raised?
Grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. Yep.
Texas is pretty great already.
Born in Dallas, moved to Fort Worth when I was about 8, and just had a good childhood. Played all the sports in high school, and my best friend's dad was an Army or an Air Force B-24 pilot, and flew over the oil fields in Germany, and luckily he made it back. Yeah, but every time I go over Jim's house, I get him to tell me a flying story. So
they got some great ones. The World War II generation, man, especially the Flyboys.
Amazing.
I mean, everybody had something to do in there.
They sure did. Sure.
You got any siblings?
I've got 2 brothers and a sister.
They serve?
No, they did. My younger son did. Oh, that's a good story right there. He went to college for about 1.5 years, and he couldn't stop drinking beer and chasing girls.
It happens. That happens.
But he quit going to class and didn't tell me about it. So that was the final
straw. That happens, too.
Yeah. And I went in there, and I woke him up, and I said, get dressed. You're coming with me. I took him downtown to the Navy recruiter and said, hey, I think my son would like to join. What do you got available? So she started checking all this. She goes, well, it was basically jobs working on the generator in the bottom of a boat. And I said, no, how about AE ratings? And she looked at me and she goes, well, that's aviation. I went, yeah. And she looked in there and said, well, no, I don't have any. I said, tell you what, why don't you check up in the basic school up there near Chicago. I know somebody didn't make it. Could you do that? She goes, yeah. She checks for a second and says, well, I've only got one, and he'd have to be there in 1 week. I said, no problem.
That's your oldest boy?
The youngest boy.
Youngest boy?
So he served 6 years. He was an AE in 3 different F-18 squadrons, made 3 cruises.
Oh, 3 pumps, huh?
He did, and fortunately he
got... Did he have fun, at least?
Oh, he loved it.
I mean, since you jerked him out of college and threw him into that.
He loved it, Marcus. He got to see Australia and see everything.
He went to Australia?
Oh, yeah.
Well, then that's worth it.
That's right, it is, I mean, yeah.
There's no better place in Australia when you're in the Navy.
The best part, he got out.
Plain and simple.
And got finished college and got a great job in electronics and best thing ever happened to him.
That's awesome.
It does do that. If you're struggling in college, get your butt in the military for four to six years, come back, and you just scream right through it.
Absolutely.
And probably have a better time, actually, because you got a little bit better head on your shoulders.
Yeah.
And the Navy will teach you how to drink properly.
Yes, they do.
All right.
When you were in high school, did you know you wanted to go in the military?
That's a wonderful story. If you want me to tell it, I'll tell it. But I went to a Blue Angel air show when I was 16 years old.
That'll do it.
Oh, that did it. And when the show was over, the solo pilot, I got him to sign a picture of him. He was a opposing solo. And, of course, very next year, I was back again. Well, he was the lead solo pilot that year, and I recognized him, and I walked up and said, hey, could you sign it again? And I don't know if he really did, but he said, I remember you from last year. You still want to do this really bad, don't you? And I said, yes, sir, I do, and hopefully I will. He says, I believe you will, son. I'll see you in the fleet. That's exactly what he said. Well, of course, that lit the fire, and I had a burning desire to just fly jets in the Navy and land on an aircraft carrier. That's what I wanted to do. And
they don't even do that in their show.
No, they don't.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that's the most dangerous thing you guys can do, right? Am I right in saying that when y'all are doing
at
carrier?
Night, yeah, all the time it is. But at night, it's really scary. The daytime stuff is so much fun. We lie, cheat, and steal to do it in the daytime, but nobody wants to do it at night.
The freaking Angels, man, they're awesome. I've watched really them so many times. They got a new documentary out, too. Went through.
My old squadron buddy is one of the guys that produced it. Rug Dance, they call him the boss, the old guy.
Yeah.
That's Greg.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Great recruiting tool.
Oh, man.
Unbelievable. I mean, more like Top Gun, the movie Top Gun got me. And then when you see the angels flying, I got a chance to go up with an angel.
Did you really?
Yeah, he knocked my ass out.
Oh, they knock everybody out.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah.
There's a video of this.
I was back there doing the hick maneuver, breathing. They teach you this maneuver you got to do to stay alive.
Yep.
He's up there with just the rearview mirror looking, laughing, like it was nothing, right? Just, you know, sitting with his arm hanging out the window or something. But I mean, just freaking awesome. And the way they fly. That was one of my best experiences when I got to go up with the angels.
Oh, I wish everybody could do it. It's phenomenal. I tried my last year I was in the Navy. I tried to get on the Blues, so I flew a jet around to all the air shows and stuff. And I had three or four of my guys that were on the team. And the way they do it to get on the demo pilot, not the leader, but the demo guys, they vote on you. And
it's a good old boy system.
It's a good old boy system. Any one guy says no, you're done.
Huh.
And I made it to the three finalists, and they picked two, and I didn't make it.
Aww.
So I said, well, I already decided if I didn't make it, I'm going to get out of the Navy. Had I made it, I'd have stayed in the Navy for at least 20 years.
Sure.
But anyway, I got out, went to Continental, met my wife, so it worked out pretty good.
Okay, so you joined the Navy out of?
Out of college.
And then went straight in. Tell me about that.
Yes, sir. I finished college in the end of July. And that was when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. And, man, that really pumped me up when I saw that. And then I got up, finished college at the end of...
Because that captured the world, right? Everyone was paying attention.
Everybody. Yes, sir.
Remind us what year that was.
69.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, July of 69.
So Vietnam is going on.
It's going on. Okay. Yep. But they had in that time right there, they had a bombing halt. Lyndon Johnson drew a line and said, you can't drop any bombs north of here. So that's why nothing got done until later on in 72. But when I decided I didn't make the team, I already decided to get out and went to Continental Airlines.
Mm. Let's talk about your time in the Navy. So when you went in, it was wartime. How was the training for that?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, and it's a great question. You're going to love this. Military guys will love this. I go down, I got out of college, you got to get a degree. So I had to stay in school three more years. And I graduated, got accepted, went to Pensacola. You got to go through officer training first. Go to Pensacola, and we had Marine drill instructors.
Oh, yeah.
Do it. And they weren't easy.
They're not.
It wasn't like Marine boot camp, but it was tough. I had no idea what to expect. My granddad, I loved him dearly, 35-year-old Army veteran. Horse Cavalry, 112th Cavalry, rode horseback in New Guinea, fought hand-to-hand combat. Do you think he told me what to expect in officer training? Not a word. I had no idea. I was like Goldie Hawn in Private Benjamin. I thought I was going to have a condo, you know.
God, I remember that movie.
Oh, really? That was me, Marcus. That was me. I really...
You show with a hairdryer.
Oh, I thought I was going to have my own condo, you know. Don't laugh. I walk in there, carry my little bag, and I had a tennis racket hanging over my head.
That's a great story.
The Canada officers, hey, come on, we got your room ready for you. Oh, man, this is great. Let me carry your stuff for you. I got about a foot away from the door. Of course, my bag went flying by this. The tennis racket went flying by. And out of nowhere, this Marine Corps Master Gunnery Sergeant shows up right in my face. And he starts yelling at me. Honestly, I thought I was in the wrong place. Really, I really thought. So when he gets through yelling at me for about 5 minutes, he says, do you got anything to say for yourself, you smart-ass college boy? Get this one. I put my hand on his shoulder.
Oh, no, you touched him.
Looked at him in the eyes, and I called him Sarge.
Yeah.
I said, Sarge, I really think I'm in the wrong place, see, because I came down here to be a Navy jet pilot. Boom, threw me on the ground. I'd never done so many push-ups in my life. That's how it started.
So when my brother went through OCS, he had his Gunny Jones. I mean, I wasn't even there, and I remember this dude. He's like, they don't mess around there. And, I mean, their job is to get you in officer shape, which is a big deal.
It's a huge deal. And he got me in
Gunny Jones, man.
He got me in such good officer shape, I ended up being the regimental commander.
Really?
Yeah.
So how long is OCS?
3 months.
Yeah.
Nonstop.
Nonstop, right?
Yes, sir.
Just to get you ready to even go into flight school.
And
which is in Pensacola?
It's in Pensacola, too.
Okay, so you just,
part of it.
When you left OCS, you just went straight across the street?
Actually, I started 2 weeks. We called it Poopyville. That's where they they were like jungle rats, you know, for 2 weeks doing everything. And then they were having too many officers attend flight school and flunk out. So when I was there, we did 2 weeks of that. Then they shipped us off to Softly Field to fly the T-34, the primary flight.
The trainer.
And we lived in the BOQ. We had beer machines. And, you know, nobody yelling at us. We were just flying. So we did 18 flights, I think it was, there. Then we had to go back. Well, as soon as we got off the bus, that gunny sergeant was waiting for us.
Yeah.
And he handed us helmets and rifles. And he, incredible leader, because he never asked us to do anything. He was right there doing it with us. The cross-country course, obstacle course.
That's the thing about them. They're in there with you.
They are.
You can't get away from them. And they're setting the damn example, right?
Yes, sir.
I mean, when you get those coaches that are just yelling at you from the sideline and just sitting there while you're doing it, that's one thing. There's an animosity that goes with that. These suckers are in there with you.
Every minute of it. Yeah, uh-huh. So, I mean, we lost a couple guys on that one because it was pretty tough.
How long is that training?
The officer training was 3 months minus the month we spent out in Softly Field.
So you come back. What's the first day of flight school like?
Well, that was the first day, flying the little T-34. But after that, we figure out, just like you saw in Officer and Gentleman, see that movie?
Absolutely.
It was pretty much true. Except
Louis Gossett Jr.
Yeah. The only thing that wasn't true, you don't get in a fight with a drill instructor. You don't do that.
Dude, that was Richard Gere in that movie, too, man. Yeah, he tried that.
I know he did. That was the only thing that ain't true. You don't do that, or you ain't going to make it. But anyway, so you go with your flight grades in Softly, and if you got good flight grades, you get jets. Of course, that's what I wanted, and they were handing them out. Man, I got jets. Went to Meridian, Mississippi for basic flight training. And then we did all that. And then we go back to Pensacola to land on the ship first time. So we're in a T2. We go out and land, do four landings on Lexington and come back. Guess how many flight hours total we have at that point? We're landing a jet on aircraft carrier. What would you think?
30?
We had 100.
Okay. 100.
But we're landing a jet on an aircraft carrier with only 100 hours. That was amazing. But we did it and then finished up there. Then
This is in the trainer? Every guy I talked to that's a pilot said they love flying that trainer.
It was a T2B Buckeye. Yeah, it was a fun little jet.
The holidays are coming, which means parties, travel, and being around a whole bunch of people. So you want to make sure to smell good, stay fresh, and not have to worry about it. That's why I've been using Mando, the whole body deodorant that actually works super well. Now, they've got a whole bunch of options, but my favorite has become the Solid Stick. Definitely part of my daily routine now. I'll throw it on when I wake up, after a workout, and even before a podcast. Definitely take it with me on my travel days, and it keeps me fresh everywhere, and I mean everywhere. Mando gives you clinically proven 72-hour odor control. It's safe to use anywhere on your body. There's no aluminum, no dyes, just long-lasting freshness that stops odor before it starts. You can choose scents from bourbon leather, that rugged cologne vibe, or pro sport if you're always on the go. And if you're looking for an easy gift this season, grab the Mando Starter Pack. It comes with stick, cream, body wash, deodorant wipes, and free shipping. Perfect for stocking stuffers. So, don't let the meat sweats get you this season. Mando has got you covered. Right now, you can get 20% off site-wide plus free shipping when you use code TNQ at shopmando.com. That is 20% off and free shipping at shopmando.com with code TNQ. Stay fresh anywhere with Mando.
But then I got to go to Kingsville and fly A4s for advanced flight training, and that was a great jet. The Blue Angels flew those for a long time.
Yeah, that's right.
It was a fun jet, and the whole thing was about a year and a half until you get your wings. Then you get shipped off to
fly. Come out with then? How many hours are you sitting when you come out, if you got 100 before when you hit a carrier?
Probably almost 300.
So how many hours are you carrying when you hit a night carrier landing?
Well, that's the first thing. When you get your wings, you go to your squadron. But you have to go through the training squadron first. Like, I got A7s, so I went out there and probably got another 100 hours in the A7 right. before we go out and land at night. And we had to do 6-night landings and 4-day landings. And then once we're done with that, we go to our squadron.
That's what you say is the hardest thing, right? Night carrier.
Landing at night, it's so difficult. It's
why? Why is it so? Why is it
the reason it is, in the daytime, you have depth perception. And you're looking at a thing we call the meatball. It's the optical landing system. Line up with the ship and your airspeed, we call angle of attack. Just those three things. Well, at night, you can't see anything except the meatball and a little drop light showing you where the ship is. That's it. So you get down to about 3/4 of a mile. You're doing instruments until then. And then they say 3/4 of a mile, call the ball. That means you have sight of a little orange ball down there showing you whether you're too high or you're too low. That's what it does. And then you develop a certain rate of descent, try to keep that ball in the center of the three datum lights on the side of it, and land on, and you can't fly by your seat of the pants, and you feel like you're real high all the time. So you want to pull off a lot of power, and that's what gets most guys is they pull off too much power. Then the LSO screams on them. They throw on full power, then they have to go around because they can't get the hook can't catch a wire because you got too much power.
So how many times do you have to screw that up before they get ready?
Well, you do that in the training squadron. If you're going to screw that up, they'll find out that there. And we lose a couple of guys just because of the night.
Right?
Yeah, just because of the night stuff, because it's so difficult. It really is.
And how many cables are along that deck?
There's four on most ships.
Midway, you got to hit which one?
Well, you target the three wire. Yeah. And these F-18s now, they're so precise and automatic, they come down and get a three wire every time.
I was going to ask you, that was going to be my next question. I bet the technology in those suckers
is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had automatic approaches, supposedly, but none of us ever did it. We didn't trust it.
So, what's it like on the catapult?
Oh, it's the most fun ride in the world. You just sit there, and in the trainer, you know, you think you can't move in the trainer, but once you get out to the fleet and you got 18 bombs on your airplane and stuff like that, and you're really heavy, it just pins you against your eyeballs. You can't even, it cages your eyeballs because it's really, really heavy. And then, boom, at the end of the shot, you're just thrown forward and you feel like you're going to drop out of the sky, but you're flying. You go from 0 to 150 in about 2 seconds.
It just works.
Works great. Yeah.
Man, I watch y'all do that. That is, I don't know. Coming off the front of that ship, because you know the ship's moving, coming at you. So if you dump in the front of that thing, man, I mean, that always gave me the heebie-jeebies.
One of my the CAG LSO in my first squadron, I love this guy. His name Jim Hayes. He had about 400 combat missions before we ever left, and he'd seen and done everything. And he had a cold cat in his previous squadron. That cold cat shot is, they don't give you enough airspeed at the end of the shot to fly, so you get to the shot, you just fall.
Oh, God.
Well, he had that, so he ejected. And then he had a good parachute, and then he lands in the water, and he's floating, and here's the ship coming right at him.
That's what I'm talking about, that dude.
Well, listen to this. This is incredible. So he thought, well, I'm done. You know, so it created a wake. He didn't separate from the parachute, which ended up saving his life, but it caught it and drug him down. And you can still breathe because when you eject, your oxygen mask, you're still wearing it. We have an oxygen bottle in the seat pan, so you can breathe O2. So he got sucked underneath, and literally he's running along the side of the ship all the way down to the back. Then he sees those big old props coming up, and he said, well, I'm dead now. So just the way the ship's wake and the props wake or whatever, it caught the parachute and pulled him up out of the way of the screws and popped him up to the surface.
That's a God thing right there.
Oh, it's totally a God.
God thing right there.
That's crazy.
I mean, my heart had stopped when I saw the ship coming at me. You know?
I know what that looks like underwater like that with those propellers.
I bet you.
It's freaking
you do.
Intimidating.
They're big.
That's a nightmare scenario right there.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine those things?
Yeah, it's intimidating. Like you can't believe. Especially if it's daylight and you can see them. No. Yeah, at night you can't, but you can hear them, though.
Yes, sir.
That's the thing about being underneath that ship. You can hear everything. And it's not only deafening, man. It hits you in the chest like a drum.
I'm glad I never had to experience that. Let's put it that way.
You're glad you're on top of the ship.
That would do me in. I don't think I could do that.
All right, so you get to your squadron, and then you get sent to Vietnam?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I got to my squadron. I got my...
Which is what squadron?
I was in VA 56 on the Midway.
Okay, check.
Attack squadron 56. It's flying A-7s. It's a single-seat fighter bomber. We knew we were going on cruise, but everything up to then was just bombing it down in South Vietnam. A little bit in Laos and Cambodia, even though we weren't supposed to, they were. But we went out, our whole squadron, our whole air wing went out just to do some refresher qualifications on the Midway. So we landed, and we're supposed to get like 6 traps or something like that. So we landed, we thought we'd get taxied up to the catapult and shot off. They taxied me over to the elevator, took me down on the hangar deck, and nobody would tell me anything. They did that to all the airplanes. And as soon as we had the last airplane, ship turns around, heads back to Alameda. Captain gets on the ship and says, "Well, boys, we just had orders from the President of the United States. We're going to war." President Nixon orders to go over early. And the reason we did, the North Vietnamese had invaded the South, a major invasion. So we were going to mine Haiphong Harbor and bomb Hanoi. And man, I tell you, they had years to save up surface-to-air missiles, AAA. And when we got over there, they shot it all. It was pretty heavy. But my first mission was down south when we first got there. They gave everybody one mission down south just to warm up, if you want to say that. And I almost got killed on that one. It was... We dropped our bombs, and we had a forward air controller on the ground, saying, "Hey, we got some Marines and troops in contact there. You guys got guns? Can you go low and help them?" "Yeah, of course." Well, this guy shot a Willie Pete, the white phosphorus rocket, to mark where the bad guys were. And he said, "Just to the east of those guys, one click, are the good guys, so don't go east of those guys." But he wanted us down as low as we could, so we armed the guns and went down to about 40 feet and shot our guns until they were shot all we had. And it
worked. How fast are you going at 40 feet?
We were doing about a little over 400.
Dang.
Yeah, would have gone faster if we could, but the faster you go, you got less time to actually visually see the guys.
You can't see it,
right? And we don't want to hit the good guys. Anyway, I pulled off target, banked as soon as I leveled my wings. I flew through about 6 Huey Cobras. I don't know how I didn't hit them, but the FAC didn't know that they were going to be there.
Huh.
And we flew right through them and fortunately didn't hit them.
That was your first mission?
That was my first mission. Then that afternoon, downtown Hanoi on a bombing mission, I mean, Iron Hand mission. I was flying with this guy. He also had a bunch of combat missions, K.T. Sanger, I'll never forget him. And we were an Iron Hand mission. It's when you go in ahead of the strike group and you have missiles on your aircraft that will home in on the enemy's radar. When they shoot surface-to-air missiles at us, our missile will guide on their radar and blow their radar up. Well, we either want to blow their radar up ideally, but also just get them to shut it off. That right. keeps them from shooting missiles at our strike group guys. So we were on our way in, and on our way in, they shot the first couple of SAMs at us, and we shot trikes. And the next thing I knew, out of nowhere, I mean, I'm flying probably 10 feet away from Ken, right between us at Mach 4, a missile, boom, right between us.
Oh, my gosh.
Neither one of us saw it. And obviously, the fuse didn't work or we'd be dead. And Ken goes, "Peg, did you see that missile?" "Yep." Yeah. And anyway, we got off target, and they bombed, and we got out of there. And I liked that Iron Hand. That was a lot of fun. That's what I got shot down doing, but...
Yeah, so you ran about 85 missions before you got hit?
Yes, sir.
How long of a time is that? Are you there for months doing that?
We went over there in April the 1st, and I got shot down on August 6th.
This is in 1972?
Yes, ma'am.
Yep. So let's talk about that. What were you doing when you got hit?
I was doing an Iron Hand. Same thing. We launched ahead of the strike group, and we had a major target in Hanoi. The bombers did. And we went ahead of the strike group, and they shot a lot of missiles at us, and Ray and I dodged a bunch of them. I dodged 2. And then the way you dodge them is you see them lift off, and then you push your nose over, and then if they come down pointed at you, well, you're the target. So this guy, they're doing Mach 4, and they're the size of a telephone pole, so the big flame coming out, you can see it when they lift off because it's really bright, big rocket engine, basically.
Are those pedestal mounted, or are they in truck?
Some are truck mounted and some are pedestal mounted. Okay. The truck ones, they can move them wherever they want. Right, right. And some of them, they just have a million of them in one spot. So you see it lift off. You see it coming at you. You build up your speed. When it gets to be about 3/4 of a mile away from you, you do a real high G roll into it. It tries to track on you, but it's going so fast it can't. So when you do your roll, you look up there and it'll blow up. A proximity fuse will light it off. And then you push your nose over and get some more speed and look for the next one coming. So I did that twice. And after the next one, they were firing three from behind that we never saw. Yeah. So right when I tried to get more speed, one from behind hit me and boom.
Engine?
Yeah. The engine quit, started shaking like crazy. And immediately I just turned toward the beach because I was headed west to try to get out over the water. And then I looked down, here's another missile coming at me. So I tried to turn into it and still tried to dogfight it, but the hydraulic system was gone. The stick was just frozen solid. I couldn't move it. Next thing I know, this thing just keeps coming by. It went right by my head about 10 feet and didn't blow up.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I was thinking all these crazy things. Man, should I eject? No, it'll hit my parachute. You know, just all these crazy things.
Is that what was going through your head?
It was going through my
head. What's it feel like when you get hit?
When I got hit, I knew it was over because my engine quit. And the airplane just went like that. And of course, you hear the loud noise. And it
like
blew.
Turbulence kind of thrust, or just like you, like somebody grabbed a hold of you?
Well, somebody grabbing a hold of you. That's what it felt like. And due to an ECM, electronics countermeasure thing we had in the jet, it puts out radar blips behind the jet that are false. Well, fortunately, instead of hitting me right in the face, it hit one of those blips right behind. So it, you know, all the frags got into the engine and the airplane. That's what took it out. But at least it wasn't a direct hit. Anyway, that thing went by and I kept going. It finally went out of control. I had my feet up here. I had both hands trying to pull the nose up. You know, I'm in a dive. I'm doing almost 500 knots now, and I can't pull up. So it's time to go. So I reached up and we have a face curtain that we pull down. It fires the ejection seat. The Air Force guys, we have one down here too, but Navy guys use this one. And I pulled it and nothing happened.
Oh my gosh.
And never quit.
Yeah.
I really pulled it. The second time, I pulled the heck out of it and it fired. But I'm going out so fast that the seat shouldn't have worked at that speed. It should have broken my neck. It tore up my ligaments in my left leg, and this is as far as I can raise my arm right here. And I'm just glad I lived through it. But next thing you know, I'm in the chute and it's really quiet for about 2 seconds. The bullet started ripping through the parachute and I knew I was going to get shot, you know, because I'm just saying, come on ground. Let me get on the ground before these knuckleheads hit me. And I landed in about a foot of water and some tall grass.
So you have a parachute.
I'm in the parachute, and thankfully, even though I was going so fast, that it worked, Melanie, because at that speed, they're not supposed to work.
Every town's got that one place where all the people just come together, where you can grab what you need, run into someone you know, or even just chatting it up with the staff before you get the checkout. For us, that's definitely Tractor Supply. That's what I love about it so much, because it's more than a store, it's a community. And Tractor Supply takes that same spirit and puts it right into their Hometown Heroes program, honoring the men and women who serve, our veterans, active duty military, first responders, and the families who back them up. Once you verify your hero status through ID.me, the perks kick in automatically. You get 2% back on every purchase, free trailer rentals and same-day delivery twice a quarter. You get also get 5% off coupons every quarter and special discounts on hero holidays like Veterans Day and 4th of July. I see those heroes in Tractor Supply all the time, loading feed, fixing gear, and just getting the job done. And I just love knowing that this program gives something back to them. So If you or someone you love is a hometown hero, go head on over to tractorsupply.com/hometownheroes and get signed up today. Because out here, we look after the people who look after us. Again, that's tractorsupply.com/hometownheroes.
That is nuts.
Oh, crazy nuts. And once I hit the ground, all the bullets were, I was in about a foot of water. The bullets were just hitting the water all around me.
Like a river or the ocean?
And no, it was a rice paddy type thing. Okay. Yeah, it's about a foot of water and tall grass and rice. And I said, I better crawl away from this chute as fast as I can. So I popped the chute, crawled away, and the bullets were still hitting. Well, I pulled out my radio, plugged my helmet into it, PRC-90. I don't know if you guys still had those or not, but I talked to Ray, the guy I was flying with, and I said, Ray, I'm alive. There's a jillion of them down here. See ya. And that's all the words I got out. They came up from behind, hit me in the back of the head with a rifle. And
oh, they were on you quick.
Oh, quick. There's a jillion of them down there.
So what happens to the plane?
It blew up.
It just blows up in the sky?
It blew up right after I jumped out of it. I mean, it was on fire. Ray told me when I got home, he said, man, everything behind your head was a ball of fire. Of course, I couldn't see it. But right after I ejected, you know, I felt the percussion, the concussion, that thing blowing up.
So what's going through your head, man, when you hit the ground? You're like, okay, I'm in a different world now.
Believe it or not, the first thing when I hit the ground was getting away from the bullets. So I crawled away. As soon as I got away from the bullets, I thought, I'd heard that the first thing that happens to you when you get shot down, other than going into shock a little bit, you're really thirsty, really thirsty. So I had a baby bottle full of water in the bottom of my G-suit. So that's the only thing I thought about was getting that thing and downing it because I knew I wasn't going to get any more. So I drank that water, and then I talked on the radio. I forgot about that, but I had to drink the water.
That's what I was asking. First. I was like, hey, what was that initial? Like when you're like, you're in the shit.
Like an actual baby bottle?
A little plastic baby bottle, you know, with a little, yeah. Little thing, but it was just had a top on it. It had it full of water, yeah.
You got a pistol on you?
I had a 38, yep.
And then they come up from, it's dark, right? Obviously,
it's, no, it's daytime.
It's daytime?
Yeah.
Oh. Like morning?
9 o'clock in the morning.
Oh.
How old are you?
25.
25?
Yep.
Oh, my gosh.
Yep. They roll up on you and knock you out, and then...
Well, they didn't knock me out. He just knocked me down, and then they set me down to wait. Ray and a couple other guys were flying over ahead, but... You know, the AAA and the SAMs, it was too much, and everything else, so they finally left. As soon as the jet engine noise disappeared, they took my bootlaces out, tied my elbows behind my back, started stealing everything, you know, my gun, my watch, everything I had. And this one guy, about that far away, I'm sitting there watching him. It's one of the local villagers. And he got a wild look on his face. And then he raised his hand. In his hand was a piece of metal about that long, kind of filed down to a point. And he ran at me and yelled. And he came at me and went like this. And right as he came down, I just lunged to the left. So he would have stabbed me right here in the face, but he got me, caught my neck right here and cut my neck. And then the only thing that saved me was amongst those dozen or so people was one North Vietnamese Army guy in uniform. Well, actually, he grabbed this guy and set him down and goes like this. The reason is, not because they liked us, but because they had orders to keep us alive. We were worth so much politically to their government. So actually, he chastised this guy, and that's the only reason they didn't cut my head off.
Oh, so some villagers got a hold of you, not a...
Yes,
not
sir.
And then there was just happened to be one Army dude there?
Yes, sir.
Were they the ones firing the SAMs?
Not the villagers, no.
No. They just hated us?
Well, yeah, they hated us because, you know, we'd drop bombs and...
Yeah, I get it.
Did all this stuff, you know.
I get it. Understandable.
But is this is in Hanoi?
This was about 10 miles northwest of Haiphong in North Vietnam, yeah. Haiphong was east of Hanoi on the water. It was a port there, port city. Anyway, I had a couple of water buffalo rides. I couldn't walk. And a couple of Jeep rides.
They belly you over the back of it?
They belled me over the back of it.
Tied you around it?
No, just belled me over. Yeah, they were kind of holding me on there a little bit. Then I had a couple of boat rides and a couple of Jeep rides. I ended up in this old prison camp in Haiphong. And that's where they took my flight suit off and gave me the fancy striped pajamas. I think I sent Hunter a picture of those pajamas.
Yeah, we'll put it on the...
And then they tried to get me to a press conference. Well, man, I was out of it. Totally
same
out.
Day? Or how many
oh,
days?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This, and I already flown two night missions before. This is my third mission. I was best.
They screaming at you and yelling and cussing whole nine yards.
All that. And then it all stopped, and they tried to be nice to get me to talk on a press conference. Of course, I didn't say nothing.
Any English?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had several people that spoke pretty good English, especially in Hanoi. A lot of them there. Anyway, I wouldn't do it, so they finally took me in. Well, it got dark that night, threw me in the back of a truck. Of course, I was all tied up and everything with a big thing over my head. They drove me straight to Hanoi, right into the Hanoi Hilton. And I got there that night. Then all the fun started.
What was that like?
Well, the first 3 weeks, I got beat up and tied up a lot in ropes. And we were so fortunate that in the end of 1970, they released about nine of our guys. And all but one didn't have the authority to come home. One guy had orders to come home because he was a seaman named Doug Hegdahl. He fell off a boat and washed up on the shore.
Oh,
that's how
on,
he
really?
Ended up. Really? That's how he ended up there. He's a great kid. Anyway, he had all names memorized of everybody in Hanoi. So
how many were there?
260 at
oh
that camp.
Gosh.
We had over 200 more in a camp near the Chinese border and another 200 at the zoo. There was 640 something total.
Okay.
But he had memorized all those names. So we had leadership within the Hilton. We had a chain of command, believe it or not, and everything. I didn't know about it. None of us did. But Doug had orders to go home. These other guys, we were not supposed to go home unless we had orders from our senior ranking officer. In other words, when John McCain, for instance, they offered him, yeah, we'll let you go home.
He wouldn't go.
He wouldn't go.
Yeah.
None of us were supposed to go. Anyway, all these guys came home. When they came home, they went on national news and talked about all the torture that was going on over there. And it made them look really bad, you know, because it was bad. And as a result of that, when we got shot down, all they did was beat us up and tie us up. They didn't break our arms and legs and all the other stuff. They actually tortured guys to death. We lost four guys that we know of in Hanoi that they tortured to death. So when we got there, we just got beat up and tied up. So they did about 3 weeks of that. They stuck a few guns in my mouth and all that. But after that, it was pretty much the bad part's over. And then I still didn't have a clue what was going on. And I went into Heartbreak Hotel. Heartbreak was part of the Hanoi Hilton. It had four rooms on either side, 7x7 rooms. And you could stand up and look out the little door and see who was coming. And there were four guys in there. Two Air Force guy right here, and Navy guy down here, and Air Force here, and Air Force here. And as soon as I got in there, I'm sitting in there just going, well, at least I'm, hopefully there's other guys here. And I hear this guy whispering, hey, get up in the window, get up in the window. And it was this Air Force guy across the hall from me. And he said, who are you? And I told him, he said, what ship are you from? I said, the Midway. He goes, hey, in room one down there, it's Gordy Page. He's from the Midway, too. Well, Gordy was flying a photo F-8 that on a photo reconnaissance mission, he had an F-4 escorting him and just saw his jet blow up. So we all thought he was dead. But it ejected him when it blew up.
Oh,
and
wow.
They caught him, and he was okay. He was a POW down there.
So he's made of bamboo, like the cells are made of bamboo, or what are they made
no,
of?
No, they're concrete.
Okay.
They were concrete, and we had 24-inch concrete slabs on either side. That's what we slept on, about 24 inches wide and 7 feet long, that kind of thing. But then, still, we didn't know anything because we didn't have contact with the outside yet. Well, Kevin asked me once I was there a few days, first of all, he pretty much saved my life because I didn't eat. I got really sick. I was hurt. I got malaria. This was infected. And I just couldn't eat any food, man. I was wasting away.
So they were feeding y'all?
Well, they gave us this junk, but I just couldn't eat it, Marcus. Yeah. I just couldn't eat it. And
what was it? Just like rice and...
No, we got no rice.
No
Vietnamese
rice?
Ate it all. We had these little things of French bread, which, pardon me, but we used it for toilet paper. And in this pumpkin soup with a piece of pig fat floating in it. And in morning, they'd give us a little can of milk with sugar in it, along with a little piece of bread about that big. I couldn't even eat that. I drank the milk because I needed fluid. But by the time I got over into heartbreak, I was still turning food away. And I was just, I'd just about given up. I'd just about given up. That's why I know what never give up means. I know you do. All you guys do. But other guys, we don't get the training all dead. And I'd just about given up. And Kevin said, guard left. And he goes, damn it, Mike. I'm starving over here, and I'm watching you push your food out. Eat the damn food, or you're going to die. That's what he said. And then along with my grandfather, I told you, that was the Army vet in Japan. When I went to war, he told me two things. He called me, and I said, I'm going to tell you two things about combat, Mike. Yes, sir. Take care of your men, and don't ever give up. And a combination of my granddad saying that and Kevin saying that, somehow I just said, damn, I better start eating and knock off this giving up stuff. And that's what shook me into eating food. Well, about 2 days later, Kevin leaves. And the next thing I know, I taught him a tap code that we learned in survival school. Well, about 2 days later, he was in a big room right next to me. So I'm laying there and I hear this tap, tap, tap on the wall right here, and it's Kevin. And so that's how I found out, to answer your question finally, that I'm in the Hanoi Hilton. Mm. We had a chain of command. I knew who all the senior officers were down there. You know, Admiral Stockdale, all those guys, John McCain, they were all down there. And I found out what our orders were. And we had a set of standing orders. And we also had a communication system that was top secret. So I can't tell you how it worked. But bottom line, they were communicating with DOD.
That's crazy.
Yep, sure was. The sad part was we fixed this when we got home. So the guys after that, we didn't have to go through. The beam counters that invented this communication system wouldn't allow DOD to tell if the families were alive. So, like, my family didn't know for 6 months that I was alive. We had guys that spent 5 years over there that they never told their
family.
Kane
was in there for seven, wasn't he, or was it five?
Who's that?
John?
He was six and a half,
I think. 6.5, 7 years?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was the toughest part when you got in there?
Toughest part was the first 3 weeks being in that room.
In the beginning?
Because they come in and just start beating on you and stuff. You never knew what to expect. And that was, even when I got in the room, they moved me out into that room with Kevin and six guys. I felt like the war was over, man, because I'm here with other Americans. And then our room grew to 37, believe it or not, later on. But the worst part is just not knowing. You know, I hear when I'm in Heartbreak Hotel, the guards would walk along and their keys would jingle. And I'd hear those keys jingling. I'd go like that. I still do that today.
Did you ever develop a rapport with any of the guards, or were they
never? No. No.
Did you learn any of the language?
No, I refused to. I didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just didn't want to.
So how long were you in there, like, as a POW?
8 months.
8 months.
Yep.
Dang.
Yep, until the B-52 started dropping bombs, and that was the greatest sound we've ever heard.
Yeah, did you know it was coming?
You know what they say, look good, feel good, right? Well, most dress clothes only get you halfway there. They might look sharp, but they're stiff, hot, and high maintenance. That's why my closet is filled up with Mizzen and Main, my all-time favorite dress shirt, and my go-to, definitely the Leeward performance shirt. Feels like an athletic tee, but looks like a custom dress shirt. It's stretchy, lightweight, moisture-wicking, wrinkle-resistant, and the best part, it's completely machine washable. You don't need to iron it, no dry cleaning, just easy and comfortable. Whether I'm on the road, recording a show, or heading to a meeting, I stay comfortable and while still looking put together. Mizzen and Main really nailed that balance. Performance fabrics with classic style. They're also a veteran-led company that gives back year-round with military discounts and support veteran organizations, which I really respect. Right now, Mizzen and Main is offering our listeners 20% off your first purchase at mizzenandmain.com with code TNQ20. That's M-I-Z-Z-E-N and Main, M-A-I-N.com with promo code TNQ20 for 20% off. And if you're shopping Black Friday through Cyber Monday, you'll get an 25% off, no code needed. It is their biggest sale of the year, November 21st through the December 1st. Make sure you check out their cyber deals and get that 25% off.
We, believe it or not, about 2 weeks prior to December 18th in 72, that's when it started, they started having air raid, silent air raid drills. So they knew it was coming.
Yeah.
They didn't know when, but they knew something was coming. And because I guess the peace talks had just broken down. And finally Nixon said, all right, well, we're going to bomb them so much they're going to give up. And that's exactly what we did.
It was my understanding that Viet Cong had a great intel system.
They did.
They knew a lot of stuff was going down before we even hit them.
You bet they did.
I mean, I heard it was exceptional.
Well, just knowing.
Like Sung Soo kind of.
Knowing they're going to bomb Hanoi. Yeah. And they knew it 2 weeks somehow. They didn't know when. They didn't know what was going to be bombed, but
so what was the day of rescue like for you?
Yeah, let's talk about your last day.
Well, it wasn't rescue. It was the last day they let us out.
Or let you out, yeah.
The war ended. They signed a peace agreement. And the peace agreement was, January 27th was the day of the agreement. Every 2 weeks, they release a group of us. And we came home in the order that we got shot down. That was the way it was going to work. And so every 2 weeks, 141 would come in, pick up a bunch of guys, and leave. And then
they just land right there at the Strip?
No, they landed in Guillaume Airport. The Hilton was, I don't know what, 15 miles away from the airport.
Was it GP all over?
I'm sorry?
They would just put you in a Jeep and shuttle you over there?
A bus? Yes, sir. And anyway, so the day there was one release group was supposed to happen a few weeks before we were supposed to go, no 141 showed up because we can hear them, you know, and stuff. So, and then the guards started treating us like crap again. They were giving us better food, still yucky, but that's the first time we had rice, a little bit of rice. And they were just feeding us carbohydrates to give us, gain some weight. But we wondered what had happened, and next thing you know, the release got on time. The day I got released, we didn't know until that morning when they walked in and gave us real clothes. But we said, okay, we going home today? In some days. That was the answer the Vietnamese gave. And we didn't know till about 3 hours later, and the way we found out, our doors open and two network newsmen walked in and they were holding cigarettes in their hand. They said, hey guys, the only way we'll get in here was to tell them we're bringing you cigarettes. So take these and make it look like you're smoking them. And just want to tell you, there's a 141 waiting for you. You're going to be out of this hole in about 2 hours. One of them was a guy named Steve Bell. He was an ABC news correspondent. The other one was Walter Cronkite.
Oh,
he was standing
gosh.
Right there in our room.
Walter.
That's, yeah. What great words. And just about 2 hours later, the bus showed up.
Did you start crying? Like, what's the...
No, I'll tell you a
story. I'm crying. That's crazy.
I'll tell you that. That's part of the story I'm getting ready to tell you right now. Got us on the bus. We drove out. You know, the B-52s just bombed them in submission. That's what happened. When we drove out of there, I bet I didn't see 300 feet without a huge bomb crater. I mean, the buildings were leveled. It was unreal. So we got to the airport. We were marching in order, walked up to the table where the generals and admirals were, and they called our name. We shook their hand. We had an escort that escorted us over to the 141. The whole time I was in there, I wouldn't allow myself to cry because I was afraid if I did, I'd lose it. So I didn't cry. the whole time. I wanted to, but I just said, I ain't doing it. I got back to the back of that 141, and here's the crew up there, the nurses, some of our guys, the flight crew, that had a huge American flag across the back, and they're playing God Bless America. I'm getting choked up telling you the story right now, and man, I cried like a baby. That was it. And I didn't stop crying until I got back to the seat in the back of the airplane. But yeah, it was surreal.
Absolutely. Did they fly you home at that time?
They flew us to Clark Air Force Base. We got out, and we spent 3 days at Clark. We were debriefing, getting physicals. They made brand new uniforms, all of our uniforms for us. And we got to call home, you know.
Where's Clark Air Force Base?
It's in Philippines.
Okay.
That's there was a big Navy base there and was a big Air Force base there, but that's where they did
it.
I'm
sure Marcus knows. I'm horrible.
What was the first thing you had to eat?
Oh, that's a great story, too. I'm glad you asked. Great question. When the first guys got home, they had all this bland stuff, soup and rice and stuff, because they were afraid their systems wouldn't handle it. So when the first bunch of guys got in, they go, "We don't want this. We want steak."
Steak. What's up?
Well, they finally figured out, well, by the time I got there, we got anything we wanted. So I wanted steak and lobster and ice cream.
Amen.
And
together.
Together.
Same time.
Oh, when I got to Oakland, I made beer milkshakes.
Man.
Just because I could.
Yeah. Why not?
Like
God bless America.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Like a Coke float, but with a beer.
Beer
shake. Yeah. Yeah. It was funny when they watched me do it. Well, two of us did it. And said, "You guys are crazy." I said, "No, it's because we can do it now."
Yeah.
And we never had anything cold the whole time we were over there.
Sure.
No ice, no nothing. So, and when I was at Clark, first thing I did was, you know, it was filthy. So I sat in the shower for 2 hours.
I did the same thing.
You know what I mean?
It was unbelievable. Matter of fact, they didn't run the water in the camp for a few days so I could have hot water.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that shower.
Me too.
Hours I was in there.
Yeah, I was there for probably 2 hours.
It's a game changer.
Total game changer, Marcus. It makes you feel like you're back in the world.
Back at home. Yeah, absolutely. That's what it did to me. The doc put me in there. He's like, "Hey, you need to go do this."
Yep, he was right.
I took a garbage can lid, one of those round garbage can lids, and sat it down in the middle of in the shower and sat down on it. God, I wasn't out there for 8 months like you, but I remember that shower, though.
Oh, I'll never forget that shower. I even remember the bar of soap I used. It was anyway, we got done with that, and I got cleaned up. They let me call my family. That was the next thing I did.
So were they expecting you to call, or did you just kind of, "Hey, what's up?"
Well, they pretty much knew that when the guys got released, X amount of time after, they were allowed to call the family, so they didn't know when.
Were you married, or?
Yeah, I was married. When I left, my little boy was 6 months old. When I got home, he was well over a year and a half, and he didn't know who it was. But a little kid that big, it doesn't take them long for them to figure out who you are.
Aww.
But
who'd you call first?
I called my wife first so I could talk to my boy. Then I called my parents and next. Cool thing, when we left from that combat cruise, I was on the Midway. We left out of Alameda, went under the Golden Gate Bridge. Well, when we got those orders for the ship to turn around, we had like, I don't know, 40 hours, 36 hours to go home, get our stuff, come back, and we're leaving. So I called my parents to say goodbye, you know, say, "Hey, we're leaving. It's 7 o'clock in the morning on this day after tomorrow." They drove all night from Denver. They were standing up there by the Golden Gate Bridge. I'm up on the flight deck. You know, we all are, because we're going to get one last look at USA. So I'm standing up there, and I'm looking up, and I'm going, "That's my family."
Oh,
it's my mom and dad, my brothers and my sister standing there. And didn't get to talk to them, but they just wanted to see me. Isn't that cool?
You know, Man in the Rails?
The enlisted guys did.
Yeah, Man in the Rails on the way out.
Yep.
That sure is so did. Cool.
That's something cool we do.
Oh, it's way cool.
It's way cool.
Yeah, especially at the Arizona in Hawaii. But when we got home, that's fun, another funny story. While we're there at Clark, we were there 3 days. And we had more adrenaline going through us, like, you know what that's like. And we couldn't sleep. We tried to sleep. And when we did try to sleep, we couldn't sleep on a bed. We had to sleep on the floor. Because we've been sleeping on concrete for, some guys, years. So when I got home, it took me almost 2 months just to be able to sleep in a bed again. You know, because I was sleeping on the floor. Because that's what you get used to.
Yeah.
It becomes normal.
Did you develop any friendships, like lifelong friendships, while you were in the camp?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the guys that were in the big room with, big time. And in fact, I wrote about a couple of them in the book. A guy named Jack Inch, he was an F-4 backseater. He got shot down about 3 weeks after me. We were on the Midway together. And about 3 weeks before that, he and a guy named Muggs McEwen, they run an F-4. They shot down two MiG-17s the same day. And, of course, Jack was afraid once he got to Hanoi, they'd find out he was one of the guys that shot him down, but that they never did. But he and this Air Force guy, every night they would tell us a movie. They would just walk up and down the hall and go through a movie and remember every detail they could. And just for entertainment purposes, and, you know, it kept your mind right. I mean, he was responsible, I told him, for the minds of all the guys in there because they did such good work. Another guy, one of my buddies, Tim Mayers, and a guy named J.B. Souter, we had some injured guys. When the B-52 guys started getting shot down, they threw them in there with us, and some of them were injured really bad. And Tim and J.B. took care of them really well, as best they could.
Did y'all sing songs or come up with sayings?
We did, until they made us quit. We'd sing God Bless America a lot. But they'd come around, made us quit, that kind of stuff. But you get pretty tight, and we'd even pull pranks on guys, you know, just whatever you could do.
Had to, right?
Yeah, just whatever.
So there was a routine that you guys would develop in there from sun up, sun down, just to kind of get through it?
Yeah, there was. Exercise, mostly. You know, once we got physically to the point where we could, you know, push-ups and set-ups.
Yeah, you got to. Right?
You have to, absolutely.
You got to own the time, not let the time own
you. Yes, sir, absolutely.
That's crazy that one guy memorized everyone's names.
He did. He did. He did it in kind of a jingle, too.
Yeah.
He made a little jingle out of it, you know, and every single one of them he got.
Dang.
But he was a sharp kid.
So when you get home, do they just retire you out of the military after
that? No, what they did, Melinda, they gave us any set of orders we wanted, whatever we wanted. We had guys go to medical school. We had guys go to law school. They paid for it, whatever they wanted. I said, I want to go to Miramar and fly a force. That's what I wanted to do. That's this airplane right here. Mm. And, you know, it was a fighter, had two big afterburning engines, and it was just mean looking.
Sexy aircraft, right?
Oh, yeah. Mean aircraft. And I just something I wanted to fly. They didn't have them. The week I got my wings, you know, you get what the Navy says you're going to get. You know how that works.
Yeah.
And the week I got my wings, they didn't have these. So I had to fly seven. So got my orders, went down to Miramar, and flew F-4s for about a year. And then I went back to Le Warren, went back in the A-7. But they gave us any orders we wanted, or they'd say, your military obligation is done today. You're out, you know, no matter how long.
They promote you?
Well, you kept getting promoted while you were in there. In other words, we had guys that were, Ev Alvarez, he was there.
While you're in, yeah, because there's still time in service.
Yes, sir, okay, absolutely. Sure. Ev was a Lieutenant JG. He was the first POW shot down, Navy guy. And Lieutenant JG, and of course, he was a Navy captain when he got back.
Oh, wow.
Or commander. He was a commander when he got back.
My gosh. So what was your first flight like after that, that you flew the plane?
That I flew the plane? Mm-hmm. Well, when I went down to, this is a great story. I'm so glad you asked. I'm at Oakland Hospital. I've been back 10 days from Vietnam. My old commanding officer, who I had more respect for than anybody in the world, one of the greatest leaders ever. I named my younger son after him. That's what I thought about him.
Oh, okay, check.
He was the command. He was the XO when I was on cruise. He's the commanding officer now. He calls me in the hospital at Oakland, and he says, "Pig, this is Skipper. How you doing?" I'm saying, "Doing great." He said, "Well, we're over here at Fallon, Nevada with the air wing and all the boys." He said, "What do you think about coming over and flying the A-7? I went, "Don't tease me, Skipper." He said, "I'm serious." I said, "Can I come tomorrow?" And he goes, "You betcha. I'll send a T-28 for you." He did. He sent a two-seat prop plane for me to Alameda. I went out there. He brought my flight gear and stuff. Went over, took me over to Fallon, Nevada. And the skipper and I went out two jets, went out, dropped some practice bombs, did a little dogfighting, came back, and I had the Admiral. I signed papers to augment into the regular Navy that day.
When I'm hydrated, everything just works better. My energy, focus, mood, all of it. And that's why I love using Drip Drop, because it's not just about thirst, it's about keeping your body and your mind running at full power. Drip Drop was developed by a doctor, and it gives you 3 times the electrolytes and half the sugars of other leading sports drinks. The formula absorbs fast, so you feel it right away. That's better focus, more energy, and no crash. It's trusted by firefighters, medical pros, and over 90% of the top college and pro teams because it just flat out works. And it tastes so great. My favorite is definitely the lemon flavor. It's clean, it's not too sweet, and it's easy to mix into my day, whether I'm traveling, working out, or recording the show. So right now, Drip Drop is offering our listeners 20% off of your first order. Go to dripdrop.com and use the promo code TNQ. That is dripdrop.com with the promo code TNQ, and you'll get that 20% off. Stay sharp, stay hydrated, and get your Drip Drop.
Imagine that, hanging his butt out, trusting my excellence to not screw up and crash the jet, that I knew how to fly it. That's what great leaders do. Mm-hmm. You know, they trust in their people's excellence.
Yeah.
And he had the guts to do it. And that's why you'd fall him over a cliff, if he said. And guess what? Remember that solo pilot, Blue Angel, that signed the autograph? That was him.
What?
My
how
commanding
cool
officer.
Is that? It's a
Lou
full
Chatham
circle.
Is his name. He's a retired admiral now.
Wow.
Yeah, he made it all the way up, huh?
Well, yep. He was awesome.
That is so cool.
So that was my first. I was the first POW to fly, because he let me.
Oh my god!
All the rest of them had to go to San Antonio and go through a vigorous training regimen down there.
Prequal kind of
all that kind of stuff. But next thing I know, I'm ATOPS qualified. So.
That is
great
so
story,
cool.
Isn't it? Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, that's a great story.
That's the kind of guy he was. Still is.
I like hearing the stories about good admirals.
You and me both.
A good leader when you hear a good one. Because, you know, the list will light up about him. Oh, this poor guy. You know what I mean? When you got a good one.
Yep.
I had some good ones, too.
I'm glad you did.
I got real lucky. All right, so when you rotated out, where'd you go?
I went down to Miramar and flew. Oh, when I got out of the Navy.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I went down to Miramar, came back to Lemoore. I was an instructor in that training squadron. And then I had another 3-year tour in a regular tactical squadron. Made another cruise on a Ranger after that.
Right.
And then because I didn't get on the Blue Angels, I got out. And got out and went to Continental Airlines. And along with all my
so
Navy
you're an ex-con.
That's I'm an ex-con, yeah. Every Navy buddy I had, we all went to Continental. I don't know why, but I guess they like Navy guys or something. So we all went there. And thankfully, I did, because about a year and a half later, I met my wife. That's a great story, too. I'm sitting on the airplane. I was giving a guy a check ride, flight engineer. I was a flight engineer on 727. I just finished. We're landed in Houston. I'm in first class filling out paperwork because I'm going to hand the guy and say, congratulations. I'm going to go home. I'm sitting there doing the paperwork. 4 of the most gorgeous women, flight attendants, walk on I've ever seen, my wife being the first one. And she walks up, and I just dropped my jaw when I saw her. And she goes, hi, I'm JJ. You going to New Orleans with us? I went, yep.
I tear the papers up.
I go fly to New Orleans. I took all 4 girls down to Bourbon Street.
Oh, that's a good time.
Gosh. Oh, yeah.
It's a great time, actually.
That's the night I met my wife. Yeah.
Good for you.
The rest is history, man.
43 years later?
Yep. Well, we dated for about 3, I guess. And then
that's awesome.
Married. Yeah.
Oh,
got married,
gosh.
Had a daughter. And
So technically, that's a blind date.
Yeah.
That pretty much was. I was blind. Blind when I looked up at her. I couldn't believe it.
I know how that feels, brother.
I'm going, you got to be kidding me. I tell you what sealed the deal, though. And this is a good story, too. She had a layover in San Diego. I was in the Navy Reserves. I stayed in for 3 years. So I was up at Point Magoo doing my reserve duty, my 2 week stuff actually. And I knew she was down in San Diego. Well, it was a Saturday afternoon late. Everybody had done flying. Skipper and everybody had gone home. And I knew she was there. My buddy Pumpkin said, Peg, she'd already been up there and met my Navy buddies. And they saw what she looked like. And she goes, Pig, she's a superstar. Get your butt down there and see her. I said, Pumpkin, how am I going to do that? He said, steal a jet. You're right. So I took a jet. I talked to this Navy chief. I said, hey, could you fill up 406 over there? Sure. So I jumped in the jet, went out over the ocean, dumped all the gas. I'm sorry, folks, but I did. As fast as that thing go, I went to Miramar. I hitchhiked up to Del Mar, got my buddy's car, stopped a couple places, got some flowers and champagne. I showed up in my flight suit still at her hotel, knocked on her door. She opened it up. Hi there. That's the deal.
A great story, and our people won't get pissed about you dumping fuel because it worked out. It's like it's a romantic story.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, and it was a long time ago.
Yeah, the fact you stole a jet too is even better. I love it when you guys do stuff like that. I've heard a couple of stories of y'all jacking the aircraft to go do something.
Yeah, well, I did. Yeah, that I figured that was so the right thing funny. To do. You know, so.
Oh my gosh! Well. So you did a career airline pilot after that.
I did. I stayed at Continental about 4 years. Then bad stuff started happening. They were losing tons of money, and they brought in a guy to run the company.
What year is this?
This was in 81.
Okay.
82. And beginning of 82. And this guy committed suicide. And this guy named Frank Lorenzo got in the picture and started buying up stock. He ended up buying the company and bankrupt it. And anyway, I saw it coming. It was obvious. So I had some Navy buddies that were already at Southwest. So I called them up and I said, hey, what I do to get a job at Southwest? And they said, well, you got to go. It's going to cost you $10,000. You got to get a type rating in the Boeing 737. Okay, where do I go? And they told me. And so I did it. But the way I got the type rating, I didn't have the money, you know, because I was living, my wife and I, we weren't married yet. I was living down in, I was. And I had a car that I drove to work in Houston. A guy pulled in front of me, hit me head on, totaled my car.
Oh, gosh.
That's how I got the money to get the typewriter.
That's another God thing, too.
But guess where I got the car? I won it on Hollywood Squares.
What?
Oh my gosh.
I won the car on Hollywood Squares when I was flying F-4s down in Miramar. Bunch of my buddies.
The TV show.
Yeah. When I was in San Diego, Marcus, they were, we were all, I hate to say it, but I feel sorry for all the guys that got treated like crap when they got back from Vietnam, but we were all heroes, you know, to the public. For why, I don't know, but we were. I mean, we got cars and stuff. We got more stuff than we deserve. But they were calling on my Navy buddies to go on TV shows. And they called me, too, and I turned it down because I had a free trip to Hawaii. But anyway, I got back, and my buddy said, man, I just wanted cars and sell boats and money. Give me her name. So I'll never forget it. Her name was Ida Mae McKenzie. She was the casting director. I called her up, and I said, hey, this is Mike. Any chance I could get another shot at this? She goes, yeah, can you come up to my house tomorrow afternoon for a little video test? Yep. Went up there. She goes, can you be in Burbank Sunday? Yes, ma'am. I went to Burbank. That we taped 7 shows, I think, in one day, and I hit the secret square. Cher Bono was the secret square.
Really?
Yeah.
You got to meet Cher?
I got to meet Cher, man, after the show.
That's one of my bucket lists. Good for you. I don't think I've ever met anybody who's been on a game show before, man.
Well, you're looking at it.
It was a blast, huh?
Yeah, we had a ball. It was so much fun. Everybody's McLean Stevenson. You remember that guy? He was a riot. Charo? You remember Charo?
Oh, yeah. Check. Okay, I know
she was on there. This guy named Hugh O'Brien, he played.
I know who that is.
Remember that is?
Absolutely.
I thought he was like 7 feet tall. He's about that tall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Everybody was as nice as they could be.
Hollywood Squares. Is that still on?
It's on, but in another, They got different people doing it, obviously. This
we're
is a
family
long time
feud
ago.
Kind of family
we
over
love
here,
family
man.
Feud.
Steve Harvey.
Did you really?
Yeah,
okay.
Steve Harvey.
We haven't done
man.
It.
We
just love
it
watching it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we try to guess all the.
Actually,
answers.
Willie Robertson and the family, they went on there,
yeah,
right?
They
so
did.
I do know somebody.
Yeah.
What was funny is that my buddies that went on Hollywood Squares, here's the deal. John Davidson, he's going to lie to you, so don't ever agree with him. And all the other people, when they look you right in the eye, you know, they ask a question. And then the person up there will answer it, and all I got to do is say I agree or disagree.
Right.
He said, if they look straight at you, like serious, that means they want you to agree with them because they want you to win the money. You know, it makes them look good.
Yeah.
So I remember the question. They asked a question, and Cher looked at me, and she gave an answer like, you best agree with me. I didn't have a clue. I went, I agree. Ding, ding, ding. Ding, ding, ding.
I don't care what you're saying, Cher. I'm going to agree with you.
We're going to have to pull that clip up and put it in the YouTube. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Phyllis Diller. Remember her?
I remember her.
She was always on there, too, I think, wasn't it?
Charlie Weaver.
Yeah.
Hugh O'Brien.
That was a great show.
That was
a lot of fun. I remember watching it as a kid, too.
It was so
much
fun.
My grandparents had that on all the time.
The best part was after the show, we'd done tape. I got to meet all those people.
That's cool, man.
And what was so funny, Cher and I are the same age. And she, I bet she didn't weigh 85 pounds. She was so skinny.
A little bit, yeah.
And she kept looking at me. Of course, when you go on, as you know, if you're on active duty and you go on TV, you got to wear a uniform.
Right.
And, of course, I'm in my, dress khakis, I think. And she goes, Mike, you look so young. You know, we're the same age.
Uh-huh.
And I said, so do you, Cher.
Yeah. How funny.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
That was a cool experience.
Good for you, man.
Okay, that's how I got the money for the typewriting anyway.
So you roll into Southwest, and how long are you over there for?
I roll into Southwest. I spent 42 years there.
It was 42 years.
And you said it started with, it was 300 of y'all, right?
300 of us, pilots in Dallas. That's how it all started. And now we got over 11,000 pilots.
Dang.
It grew like crazy.
That's a great organization.
Absolutely.
Okay, you know, I always have a lot of fun. I'm a United guy, ex-con too.
Houston's our hub.
Yep.
But every now and again, we'll get on one, and I always marvel at how much fun the flight attendants have on the flight. It's like entertainment. They make it great.
Oh, I tell you, Marcus, they still do occasionally, but back when I started, you know, we got away with murder. I mean, we really did. We'd pull up and fill the airplane up. I mean, people are still walking down the aisle. We taxi back because we would actually pull in, offload people, offload bags, unload people, unload bags, and push back in 10 minutes. We did it.
Yeah.
And we actually
so it's possible.
We did it a lot, and until the FAA got a hold of what we were doing, I can't believe we got away with it as long as we did. And
they said
you can't do that no more. It's unsafe. Okay.
That's crazy.
But it sure was fun while it lasted.
Southwest, yeah. As a kid, we said this before we started recording. As a kid, I commuted between Dallas and Houston. My parents were divorced, and I flew by myself starting at 8 years old.
Yeah.
And I always felt safe. There was never a time. That was back when the bulkhead seats were facing each other. Do you remember that?
I remember it well.
Now they don't have that anymore, but they had it. They had two sections of the seats that face each other in the front,
in the back,
and then in the back.
That's where all the smokers were.
Yeah, okay. And they smoked.
Yeah, they did.
On the plane.
As if there was a different section, right? And like, hey, man, don't worry, we're in a locked freaking tube.
People smoked next to me. The chairs had ashtrays.
I know. Certain, they had X amount of rows. I forgot what it was. But X amount from their back, you could smoke like it was going to make a difference, like
yeah.
I said.
Like,
all right. But that's
so
what happened.
Funny.
And those lounges, there were lounges, the ones that faced each other. Flight attendants called the people that sat in there. They were the ones that drink the heaviest.
Yeah.
They call them lounge lizards.
Oh, my gosh.
Of course, they didn't let the people hear them say that, but that's what they called. It was funny.
Well, I don't know where they put the child, the unaccompanied child in there, but I always sat in those seats that faced each other. And I had a big remember those carbon papers like you would write on the first one and
sure
there was tear-offs?
Yep.
They would hang that on a little pin and it would have all my information on it, my address, a couple of people's phone numbers.
Mailed.
Literally, like I was a UPS package.
Yeah.
But that's how I would get back and forth to see my mom and dad.
You got a book coming out.
Yes, sir. It's out.
Let's talk about that.
Man, what a lot of work. I'm glad it's done.
How'd that make you feel?
Oh, it made me feel great, Marcus.
Okay, tell me the name of it.
It's called Hope and Courage, a POW's Guide to Life, Recovery, Success, and Peace of Mind.
We'll get everybody to get a hold of this man and read it and push it out as fast as we can. But
well, thank you.
Like I said, how'd it feel to write it?
When I started, the first chapter is, here I am on a catapult on the Midway getting ready to be launched for my first, for the mission that I got shot down on. And I go through that chapter, getting shot down and all that. Then it alternates chapter. The next one is, here I am 14 years old in a guitar player in a rock band growing up in Fort Worth. And it just progresses there each time. And fortunately, it worked out really well. I was surprised at how well it did work out, and I'm thankful. But I had a buddy of mine, old Marine guy, Force Recon Marine, said, you need to write a book. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll get to it one day, you know. And finally, about a little over 3 years ago, I started. But when I retired from Southwest earlier this year, I went at it every day till I got it done, and I'm glad I did.
Well, once it bites you, man, you can't stop.
It is. And if I could tell you this quick story about why I wrote the book, four of us did a presentation for the Army at Aberdeen Proving Grounds outside of Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And they wanted four of us, one each from branch of the armed forces. Well, my buddy Frank was a Marine. I was a Navy guy. We had an Air Force guy, Rick Searfoss. He was an astronaut. And the Army guy, you might have heard of him, Rocky Blyer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
He was the Army guy. What a great guy. And anyway, we did this program. Couple thousand people. And I was the last one to speak. And when I got done, you know, you talk to people and do stuff. And then finally this enlisted kid in uniform, in his khakis or dunger or those things, camouflage things. Captain Penn, can I talk to you in private for a minute? Absolutely, son. Walked over there. And he said, sir, I just want to let you know, this morning I decided that I was going to kill myself tonight. But after I heard you speak about never losing hope, and if you keep hope, it will give you the courage to never give up, I'm going to be okay now. I don't know how I could ever repay you. I said, son, you just did. That's why I wrote the book. If I could save one life with that book, it's worth it. It really is.
Oh, your perseverance is unbelievable.
You're
a walking example of that.
The best thing, when I got back, you know, I lost both my parents, and I developed a pretty serious drinking problem. And my wife had set this up for me, even though I didn't know it. I was picking up my younger son. He was coming in on aircraft carrier into the cruise. Picked him up. I drove him back to Lemoore. It's where all the F-18s are right now. And on her way back, she said, hey, there's this place near Malibu. I want to show you something. You want to stop by there? Let me show you. Sure. Well, we pull the car up. She pops the trunk, goes out, throws my suitcase out, and she goes, I reserved a room for you in there for a month. If you don't stay the whole time, you're never going to see me or daughter ever again. That took a lot of
guts. Oh, you married a strong woman.
Very strong woman. And well, I spent about the first 4 or 5 days trying to figure out how I'm going to get my butt out of this place because sure. I don't belong here. You know, I ain't like these people. Mm-hmm. And then I had a ex-Marine counselor that had about all my mouth he wanted to hear. And I said something smart-ass remark. And, man, he went over there, picked me up, threw me against the wall. He said, Mike, you're 51 years old. Your way of doing things got you here. Why don't you shut up and let me tell you about a better way of life? And, oh, by the way, you know how you felt when your dad killed himself? Do you want your kids to feel the same way when you do it? Boy, when he said that, my knees buckled. And that's when I got serious and go, yep, I really do have a problem. I better do what I need to do. So I did. And that was 28 years ago.
Dang. Thankfully. That would make me cry.
Oh, no. And I had to go to aftercare because I lied about it to Southwest because I didn't want them to know I was there, right? So as soon as I got it together, I called my boss and told him where I really was. And anyway, I was off about 6 months. And when you go through a program like that for pilots, it's a wonderful deal because you have to be off 6 months. You have to go to meetings and go to treatment and all this stuff. And then you jump through some hoops and interview with an FAA shrink, and you get back to work. And the company pays for it.
That's so awesome.
It's a great deal. That way you don't lose a pilot.
Yeah.
And it worked out great. And so I was going through this aftercare program, this doctor, for about 2 years on Saturday, and he called me one night, and he said, "Mike, I need you to do something for me." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I'm having some serious surgery tomorrow. If I don't survive, you got to run this group." He said, "You're the only one they're going to listen to. You know, I'm no professional." And I told him, I said, "It doesn't matter. They'll listen to you."
And he died. Street cred.
He died.
He died?
Yes, sir. He died. So I've been running this group for 26 years, every Saturday morning.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. Still?
Still.
Good for you, man.
Every Saturday morning, Marcus. Yep. So fortunately, been able to help some people. So that's what we do.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Well, you definitely gave your heart of service to America, man. Thanks for doing that.
As you well know, I know you feel the same. When I say I'm glad to be here, I'm glad to be here.
Yes. We're glad you're here, too.
Thank you.
Glad you stayed.
Well, thanks for coming on, bro.
Yeah, thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you guys so much.
Story out, man.
Inspirational. So how can people buy the book?
It's on Amazon. It's in that paperback book, and they have it on the Kindle. Absolutely, too.
Can people buy signed books?
Well, if they want to have an event, I can sure sign them for them. I did one yesterday. I did one for Morgan Stanley downtown.
Oh, nice. How do they get a hold of you for that?
Well, the book, I've got a website in the back, and it's got a link to it on there. And right through there. Easy.
Awesome.
I appreciate that.
Thank you, brother. Great job, man.
Thank you, sir. Very much.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.